Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3127 et al., United States of America versus John Tay Robinson, also known as Tay Appellant. Ms. Hughes for the appellants, Ms. Winchester for the appellee.
Ms. Hughes, good morning.
Yes. May it please the court. My name is Kristen Hughes, and I'm here on behalf of John Tay Robinson, Tommy Dorsey, and Kenneth Dodd. I appear before you today for the first time and pro bono, hoping to right a wrong in which I participated as assistant to trial counsel for Kenneth Dodd. The issue before the court today is whether the appellants, Mr. Robinson, Dorsey, and Dodd, young men with little formal education, knowingly and voluntarily consented to 25 years of imprisonment. The district court's decision denying the each individual defendant's motion to withdraw his plea is reviewed for abuse of discretion. And in determining whether or not discretion has been abused, the main criteria that this court has looked at is whether or not the plea was tainted and whether or not the individuals had a legally cognizable defense to the charges. There's actually three issues that I'd like to focus on today. One is the issue of the evidentiary hearing. The other is the issue of whether or not the court erred and the significance of that error when the court failed to advise Tommy Dorsey of his constitutional rights. The third issue I'd like to focus on is Mr. Dodd's second motion to withdraw his plea on the basis of changes in the sentencing guidelines. There's no doubt, it's not disputed, that the trial court failed to advise Mr. Dorsey of his constitutional rights. The government has cited several cases where they claim that you have to reach plain error. But the cases that they're citing, what was omitted from the instructions, in one case was a matter of the elements of the crime. In another case, sealed case, they didn't explain the elements of the crime of conspiracy. In Kasten, the court found that based on the colloquy that the defendant had actually understood what the rights were. His responses clearly indicated that he understood what was happening. In Mr. Dorsey's case, he was not advised that he had a right to a jury trial. He was not advised he had the right not to plead guilty. He was not advised he had the right to confront witnesses. He was not advised he had the right not to testify as well as the right to testify, and he was not advised that he had the right to call witnesses on his behalf.
Now, he was in the courtroom when all those rights were read to his two co-defendants.
Yes.
And I realize each defendant has a right to a Rule 11 colloquy. He also answered yes to, had his counsel advised him of his choices and his options, right?
Yes.
And the plea agreement also contained his rights. Well, maybe
yes.
Not. Did the plea agreement contain all the
yes.
rights that come from the
yes, but there's no evidence on the record to the extent to which Mr. Dorsey consulted advisor the time he spent reviewing the plea agreement. He himself has said that when he addressed the court pro se, that all of his discussions with counsel were about the evidence that was against him. Nothing removes the obligation from the court to individually address a defendant who is taking a plea and advise them of their rights.
Following up Judge Henderson's question, did the judge elicit from Dorsey whether he had read the plea agreement?
I'm sorry?
Did the judge elicit from Dorsey whether he had read the plea agreement?
I believe she asked if he was aware of it or had seen it, and he said yes. But that's not a substitute, again, for the court's obligation to find out if the plea was intelligent.
Plain error, it's got to affect the outcome. Right, or have some non-zero probability of affecting the outcome. If well, calling the plea agreement, he's read the plea agreement. How would it affect the outcome?
I think according to Dominguez Benitez, the gravity of this particular error in the plea colloquy is so great that they say it doesn't really matter if the defendant even says he would have pled guilty anyway. If the record contains no evidence that a defendant knew of the rights he was putatively waiving, this is Boykin v. Alabama, the conviction must be reversed. Would argue that the Dominguez case raises it to a constitutional question that the plea was not knowing and voluntary. Absent a direct discussion with Mr. Dorsey, which did not take place, he was not advised of those rights. The court cannot make an inference that they're understood. The court has a duty to investigate and look. I'd also like to talk to you about Mr. Dodd's second motion to withdraw his plea. And the government, in its response to our motion, completely failed to address, I think, a very important issue. And in all the cases that they cite, their cases that have been decided under USCA 3582 C2, and it's a matter of retroactivity. Mr. Dodd's reasons for asking that he be allowed to withdraw his plea is not retroactive. Every one of those cases is retroactive. Mr. Dodd's is not. He made his plea on January 7th, 2007. The court accepted the plea. The court did not accept the plea agreement. And the government, that's undisputed. Sentencing guidelines were changed in November 2007. Mr. Dodd was not sentenced until May 5th, 2008, 16 months later. At the time Mr. Dodd was sentenced, different sentencing guidelines were already in place. He's not asking that you go back retroactively and apply them. He's asking that you acknowledge the ones that were in place on the date that he made his plea. There's only one case, really, that I found that addresses this issue, and that's Melendez-Perez, a Puerto Rican case. The government also has said, and one of the cases has said, you look at it as a contract issue. The 11C plea is a contract. Therefore, you don't look to the guidelines. But for purposes of argument, let's consider it a contract. The contract is not made until the court accepts the plea agreement, not the plea, the plea agreement. Therefore, at the time of sentencing, the court had not yet accepted the plea agreement. It had made quite sure that she didn't know if she was or there were going to be other changes. The timing for Mr. Dodd is absolutely critical.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Amanda Winchester on behalf of the United States. The district court did not commit plain error by failing to advise appellant Dorsey of certain rights during his plea colloquy. And it is correct that to demonstrate prejudice in the context of a guilty plea, Mr. Dorsey must show a reasonable probability that but for the error, he would not have entered this plea. And on the current record, that's just something that Mr. Dorsey is not able to do. First of all, I'd like to note that although the government has not in its brief pressed any kind of waiver argument, at the plea hearing itself, counsel agreed that it was acceptable to them to conduct a collective plea colloquy, that is, that all of the defendants would go over their rights together. The court declined to do that, and for preservation of the record, because she wanted the record to be entirely clear, she went over these rights with every single one of the defendants in turn. But even assuming that in one of those particular plea colloquies, the court erred to go over certain rights in detail, the error in this case does not amount to plain error under Rule 52B because the record makes clear that Appellant Dorsey had actual knowledge of the consequences of his guilty plea. And that is because Mr. Dorsey's guilty plea occurred after his co-defendant's pleas had concluded. The district court had already just advised Appellant Dodd and Dorsey's presence of all the rights that Appellant Dorsey now claims he was uninformed. The court then informed Mr. Robinson of those same rights in Dorsey's presence. The court may infer from this record that Dorsey had actual knowledge of the rights that were inadvertently omitted from his plea colloquy. Beyond what was actually occurring there in the courtroom, as this court has noted, Dorsey's written plea agreement, which he did read and he acknowledged before the court that he signed and understood, contained all of the rights that he now claims he was uninformed and had not received. In fact, Dorsey doesn't contend that he was unaware of his rights, actually, or that he was injured by the court's failure to comply with Rule 11. He claims no specific prejudice. And so he cannot, by virtue of no prejudice, create a reasonable or support a reasonable probability that but for the Rule 11 error, he would not have entered his plea. So even if this court finds the district court failed to scrupulously follow the procedures set out in Rule 11B1, Dorsey's not entitled to relief because there was no prejudice to him, no prejudice to his substantial rights, and the error did not seriously affect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the proceedings. Turning to the second argument advanced here today, the district court properly denied defendant Dodd's motion to withdraw his guilty plea due to the sentencing guidelines crack amendments. And the government would agree, it's been noted here today that most of the cases applied the principles of the retroactive sentence reductions. The government would agree that most of those cases cited both in appellant's brief and in response in Appellee's brief really don't address the issue that we need to look at today. And we would offer this court to look primarily at Brady versus United States, which the court cites primarily in its brief and which appellants have failed to address even today. Brady makes clear that a defendant is not entitled to withdraw his plea merely because he discovers long after the plea agreement has been accepted that his calculus has misapprehended the quality of the state's case or the likely penalties attached to alternative courses of action. So even though there is a later change in the penalty associated with the plea, Brady makes clear that as long as the plea is voluntarily made at the time it is entered, that a defendant is not entitled to plea withdrawal for those reasons.
Their argument is that there was no acceptance of the agreement.
That is a separate argument that they make, Your Honor, and we have, again, additional responses to that. We would argue that in the context of the entire plea agreement, not only the plea agreement, written plea agreement, but the words used by the district court itself during the plea colloquy, the context was entirely clear that this plea was accepted. At the end of every plea colloquy, the court specifically said that it would accept the pleas conditionally pending the pre-sentence report and would sign the waiver of trial by jury. And that was repeated as to each defendant. There was no ambiguity noted by the defendants themselves as to whether they had any misunderstanding as to whether those pleas were accepted. And it was clearly the intent of the parties at that time that those pleas be accepted.
Well, I guess their focus is conditional.
Correct. And we argue that there's really nothing wrong with that. Conditional pleas are, in fact, expected in the Rule 11C1C context, and they're not only expected but certainly permissible under the rule. And as the Hyde case makes clear that we cited in our brief, such conditions subsequent do not nullify otherwise valid acceptances. Correct. I mean, the idea is that the only reason it's conditional is because if the court later chooses not to accept the underlying agreement, then that allows the defendant the opportunity to withdraw his plea. But at the time of the plea hearing itself, the plea was accepted. That was the anticipation of everyone involved. That was the expectation that the government set out when it sent its plea offer to the defendants and memorialized that in an email. The condition was that it would ask the court to accept the plea agreements or the pleas at the time of the plea hearing. And there's no indication in the record that there was any confusion about that. If there are no other questions before concluding, I would just like to raise the particular nature in this case of the government's prejudice if this plea were withdrawn. As the district court correctly found, the argument that there's no prejudice to the government in this case overlooks the interest of 100 or so witnesses whose lives would again be disrupted and the cost of the United States in reassembling the witnesses and evidence for trial, to say nothing of the imposition of the district court. This is a months-long, complex criminal case. The defendants in this case escaped the possibility of trial and only reasserted belated claims of innocence as part of their motions to withdraw pleas months after their pleas were entered and after it was too long to be included in the ongoing trial of their death penalty co-defendant. There is significant prejudice to the government in this case in retrying it if these pleas were withdrawn, and all of the factors together combined should indicate to this court that the district court therefore did not abuse its discretion in denying appellant's motion to withdraw their pleas without a hearing. And if there are no further questions, we'd ask that you affirm the order of the district court. Thank you.
Ms. Hughes, why don't you take, if you needed to respond to anything the government has said.
In regard to Mr. Dorsey, we'll acknowledge that Mr. Dorsey was in the courtroom when his co-defendants were advised of their rights. The government should also acknowledge, it just said Mr. Dodd was informed, Mr. Robinson was informed. What happened when Mr. Robinson was informed? The court said, do you understand the point I'm making? And he said, no, ma'am. So in Mr. Dorsey's presence, there was another defendant who indicated he did not understand what the court was saying. But you know what? Dominguez says, if the record shows there's no evidence that the defendant knew of his rights that he was putatively waiving, and there's no dispute that the court did not read Mr. Dorsey his rights.
That's a jump you're making.
Yeah.
You jump from a sentence which talks about evidence the defendant did not know to the question of what the court said. There are other ways in which people gain knowledge.
Well, the court had an obligation under Rule 11.
That's a different issue. But that takes us presumably into the question of whether there's plain error.
Well, if the inference is that he did not know of his rights, Dominguez says that even by overwhelming evidence that the defendant would have pleaded guilty regardless will not save the situation, and we would argue that that is the situation here. As far as Mr. Dodd goes, we did address Brady in our reply brief, and we said Brady was not relevant to this case. Brady is a case where Brady tries to withdraw his plea 8 years later, and the change again occurred after sentencing. The government cannot get away from that fact. You know, they keep saying contract. Here's Scurlark, March 2009, says the plea agreement, the 11C plea, binds the court once the court accepts the plea agreement, not once the court accepts the plea. And Your Honor brought up Jones. This court has made a big distinction in terms of when you can withdraw a plea or not between when the plea is accepted and when the plea agreement is accepted. In this case, the plea agreement was not accepted. Under contract, let's use the contract analogy that the government likes. This is a contract of adhesion. All the bargaining power is on one side. What's more, there was common mistake. The contract, at the time that Mr. Dodd asked to withdraw his plea, the contract was not completed.
All right.
And we would ask you to allow these three gentlemen to withdraw their guilty pleas.
Thank you.